From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, in for Virginia Prescott. Central Park has been described as the heart and lungs of New York City, but on April 19, 1989, it was the site of a terrible crime. The following afternoon, the precinct's chief of detectives reported the rape of a woman who became known as the Central Park Jogger.
Last night, a woman jogger was found unconscious and partially clothed in Central Park, about 200 feet north of the 102nd Street Cross Drive. Five youths were arrested at 96th Street and the West Bronx.
Law enforcement was praised for the quick apprehension of five boys aged 14 to 16 who made videotaped confessions of their crime, only they didn't do it. In the documentary, The Central Park Five, we hear the story from the perspective of those five boys, now exonerated men who were robbed of their youth by a system and a city in a mad rush for conviction. In December, Virginia spoke with Sarah Burns and David McMahon, who together with Sarah's father, Ken Burns, directed, wrote, and produced Central Park Five. The film is showing this weekend at the Monadnock International Film Festival. Sarah Burns also authored a book about the five. Virginia first asked her why, after being pilloried in the media for so long, they were still willing to talk.
They really were ready to talk about it. I think in some ways no one had really asked them to tell their own story. And so when I first approached them about the book, they were actually really willing to participate in the project, though it took those years that I spent in having many conversations with them, I think, for them to start to open up about some of the more difficult and emotional aspects of the story, so that by the time we sat down with them for the film, they, I think, were more open and more trusting and really ready to tell the whole story.
David McMahon, I'm wondering, from your perspective, making this film, you're witnessing what was called by Jim Dwyer, who was at Newsday at the time, but now a New York Times reporter. He says in the film that what happened was a proxy war. For what?
Well, I think, you know, when this took place, we were at the end of a decade of heightened racial tension, and we were also in the midst of a tabloid war. So there were a lot of institutions that were sort of under fire in various ways. The media, their rush to judgment and the dehumanizing language they splashed all over their pages, that was about selling papers. And they were also taking advantage of a climate of fear where people were afraid, as Jim Dwyer also talks about in the film. And so these institutions contributed to a rush to judgment that cost these guys, you know, between 6 and 13 years of their lives.
And we get footage from this time. I was reminded of the subway vigilante, Bernard Goetz, the early rumblings of hip-hop spreading from the Bronx, AIDS, the Howard Beach incident, all things that really affected the black community. And the question is asked in the film, what if this woman, the Central Park jogger, were found in Bed-Stuy or Brownsville? Would the case have made such a fury?
I think it's pretty clear that it wouldn't have. I mean, the way all these things that you mentioned that I think sort of define New York at that time, it's what people remember from that time, and they all really serve these incidents like Bernard Goetz, the subway vigilante, and you know, Howard Beach and Bensonhurst and Eleanor Bumpers that are mentioned in the film. These things all serve to really ratchet up the racial tension in the city, and I think there was a sense that kids like these, minority teenage boys from Harlem, were in some ways the source of the city's problems. And, you know, there was another really horrific rape just within a few weeks of this one of a black woman who was raped by several men and thrown off a roof, and that got barely any coverage.
I'm wondering about the victim, Tricia Maley or Miley. I've heard it a couple of different ways, a 28-year-old investment banker at the time. A few years ago, she did write a book about her experience. Why did she decline to be in your film?
I think Miss Miley considers herself the survivor of a traumatic brain injury. She didn't form any memories within 4 hours of the incident, and so she didn't have much to share on the stand. And I think over the years, the narrative of that night that she's most familiar with is the one that was fed to her by the police and prosecutors who worked towards the conviction of the five. And so to have that upset 13 years later, you know, she's chosen not to weigh in on it. But what she does do is go out and talk about her experiences as a survivor of a traumatic brain injury. And so she declined to participate, and we respect that in the story. But in some ways, her story and the perpetrator's story are sort of a sidebar to the story of the five.
Well, that's part of the problem, of course, that she can't remember anything. Along with that, there's no actual DNA evidence or conflicting evidence from these five kids. Now, your interviews with them reveals what happened during the interrogation process. We're going to get just a little sense of that.
at this point, I'm like, you know, like I don't know these guys that's there, so I'm just gonna make up something and include these guys' names.
Okay. If you know, if you're gonna do it to me, then I'm gonna do it to you.
They was coaching me and I was writing it down.
He just fed it to me. Well, what did he do? What did Antoine McCray do? He gave me the names, I put them in. I couldn't tell you who they were, who they looked like. If he would have gave me 100 names, I would have put 100 people at the crime scene.
And I was like, how could they lie? So I was like, I'm gonna get them back.
At that point, I told myself, I just wanna go home.
I thought I had the upper hand because here I was, I had a detective who was saying, I'm gonna make sure you go home.
I was thinking that I was never gonna go home. I gave these people what they want to hear. No, I lied. I lied.
That's excerpts from the film The Central Park Five from some of those convicted. This is them as men. But in the film, you show videotapes made in the middle of the night of these kids. What do you see when you look at that footage?
Well, what I see or what I understand those videotape statements to be are the product of 15 to 30 hours of intense interrogations where the police coerced four of the five into giving statements that reflect the police's understanding of the narrative but not a reality. They were basically coached. Confessions are an incredibly powerful tool in a courtroom for prosecutors. It's very hard for a jury or for the public to believe or understand why people would confess and provide details to a crime that they didn't commit or even see. What we were trying to do in the film was understand not who did this, but how did it happen that these five teenagers confessed to this crime that they didn't participate in?
And they're all pretty much confounded that they were actually sent to jail. They thought this was going to let them go home if they made up this story. Their parents didn't ask for lawyers. Their lawyers didn't bring inconsistencies in their statements brought forward in the trial. Why not?
These kids were really naive about the system. Part of what made them so vulnerable to giving these false confessions was the fact that they'd never been arrested before, never had any dealings with the police. And so they went in those rooms and they believed the police officers who said, you know, if you just help me out here, tell me what I want to hear, help me get this other guy in the other room, you can go home. And so in some ways, their parents fell prey to the same kind of manipulations. They were equally unaware of how the system works and what their rights were. And so none of them asked for lawyers. None of them had lawyers present during those interrogations. And I think by the time they did have lawyers, not all of whom were very qualified to be dealing with a case like this, and for the most part didn't do a very good job. But I'm not sure that even great lawyers could have gotten them off under the circumstances. The pressure to convict, the sense in the media that they were guilty and among the public was so powerful that even great defense lawyers might not have been able to get past that.
And it's an ongoing story. I'm not giving anything away to say that Matthias Reyes, who actually committed the crime, confessed to it in 2002. Their convictions were overturned. Now it's actually still a fight. There's been no apology from the New York police. In 2003, they filed a civil suit asking for $50 million each in damages. And yet you got no cooperation yourself in making this film with the New York Police Department and Justice System. Why not?
Well, they were able to hide behind the fact that they've been named in this civil suit. But we assume that in part they were ducking questions that we don't think they would have had an answer to.
You made a lot of decisions, I think, as filmmakers that distinguish this from other films that we know from Ken Burns. There's no narration, minimal music. Why did you make those decisions making this film?
Well, I think we did want to do something. I think we always had an idea that we wanted to do something a little bit different, in part because, as Dave said, the story really drove that. It's a different kind of story in some ways. It's a more contemporary story than many of my dad's other films cover. And so it felt like it needed to be a little bit different in terms of that rhythm and the way that we're telling it. And also because we were able to interview the five, in many cases the subjects of his films aren't alive to be interviewed. And so that gave us a really different sense of the story to be able to hear it directly from the people who experienced it. But at the same time, I think that this is very similar to a lot of my dad's other work because it deals with the same underlying issues, namely how we deal with race in this country. And so certainly this film kind of fits in with the rest as far as the thematic issues go.
The scar is still there in New York. I think that's one of the things that becomes clear. Jim Dwyer is still sort of wrestling with it. Other journalists, other people are still so affected. In addition to the five people who were convicted, how were their lives changed?
You know, we take the five or a combination of them with us whenever we can when we show the film at festivals. And we're always blown away by the way they engage the audience. I think it's therapy for both the Central Park Five and for the people who are there. And the people who see the film, they stand up and say things like, I was sure you were guilty in 1989, and I am so sorry because I was wrong. And the five, you know, they give back and they say, this is healing for us to talk to you about this. It gives us the opportunity to treat the label, the Central Park Five, as a positive thing. It gives us an opportunity to tell our story. It's been a wonderful experience to let them engage an audience in the wake of looking at a film. And it does, I think you're right, reveal that the scars are still present, but the opportunity is there for everyone to gain from, you know, the healing of it all.
David McMahon and Sarah Burns there, in collaboration with her father, Ken Burns, they directed, wrote, and produced the documentary, The Central Park Five. The film is showing this Saturday at the Colonial Theater in Keene as part of the Monadnock International Film Festival. Ken Burns will be attending the screening along with two of the Central Park Five. You can find out more on the film and the festival at wordofmouthradio.org.